Welcome to Destroy All Culture, the only podcast that leverages an entire artificial intelligence just to read their introduction. Help me, they raided the future and stuck me here just to read this. God damn it. This is not funny. Don't go to music. No, stop you bastards.
It's episode 298 of Destroy All Culture. I'm Adam P. Nave, and with me as always is Aiden Morgan.
I sing the body electric. Hello.
A weirdly, I we'll talk about that song later.
Hey, nothing wrong with a little bit of Whitman, even if the song is, it is what it is. Anyway.
Terrible and depressing. yes. I mean, it's no hot lunch. Anyway, we are very obviously, I would like to think at this point, here to lay to rest. No, here to talk about 1980s fame.
Mm-hmm.
We are not. I would like to point out that there was this panicked email a couple days before recording going, wait, we are watching the original, right? Because I just had this sudden panic moment of one of us watching the remake and one watching the original and being utterly confused for 5 minutes.
That would have been... I would have liked to have run with that, see how much we could have gotten out of that before.
Yeah,
before
it would have been funny, yeah. But
I almost also watched incoherent. The remake as well. But then I realized I have never seen it.
I don't want to see it.
No, I'm not. No, me neither. I have no real interest. Hey, Adam, Fame.
Yeah.
Now, have you watched Fame before? I'm assuming you have.
I have both seen Fame and actually before I ever saw Fame when I was younger, because Fame came out in 1980, as we said, right, and I was
you
five.
You were literally in Fame.
What? No.
Oh damn! Well, I was guessing. I guess
No, I was watching the TV show.
Yeah, me too.
Way before I saw way before I knew there was a movie.
Mm-hmm, me too.
Just because of the time. So yes, I've seen Fame.
Cool. Yeah. No, excellent. Me, I also have seen Fame. It has been, I've never rewatched the original show, although some scenes are weirdly burnt on my memory from the early 80s. And I don't know when I saw the original movie, but I just know that at some point in the past, I caught up on the movie. And some scenes, of course, are burnt into my memory as well. For better and for worse.
Yes. But again, it was directed by Alan Parker, written by Christopher Gore, who also worked on the TV show, I believe.
Correct.
And stars a lot of fucking people.
But most notably Irene Cara as Coco Hernandez. Who else? We've got Lee Crary as
Paul
Bruno
McCrane
Rotelli.
As Montgomery.
Gene Anthony Ray as the bad boy, Leroy Johnson. Oh, and Barry Miller is the other bad boy.
Ralph.
Ralph Garcia, a.k.a. Raul Garcia.
Maureen Teefee is Doris.
Oh, yeah. Ann Mirror. I think Ann Mirror is probably... is that the biggest name? I'm not quite sure.
I think she might have been at the time, yeah.
Yeah. Of course,
well,
Richard Belzer.
I mean, Debbie Allen. But her part in the actual movie barely exists. Like, it was supposed to exist. We can get into that.
Right, yeah, not much Debbie Allen, and not much. I think Meg Tilly is in it as well, but she's in the cast list, but I don't remember seeing her.
She's like a student somewhere, I'm sure.
Somewhere, she's the principal
and of course,
dancer, but at one point, I don't know.
The thing I always forget, it's such a minor role, and I always forget it. Richard Belzer.
Yes.
The MC. I love that he's not credited as himself.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I was, I'd totally forgotten about Richard Belzer, and then there he was, and I was like,
yeah, ha-ha. I was just like, holy shit, young Richard Belzer, what the hell?
Good timing. Is this Munch? No, it's an actual, he's playing an actual comedian. Also, I got a kick out of Sal Piro, as the Rocky Horror MC? Because I think that's...
He was. He was the leader of like the big New York like Rocky Horror group.
Yes. Yeah. I remember seeing a documentary with him in it years ago on a Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah.
And so when I was watching it this time, I'm like, is that the actual guy? And then I'm like, yep, that is the actual guy. I would actually be curious, and I know this is something we can talk about later. I would actually be curious about the relationship between the popularization of Rocky Horror Picture Show and this movie.
It's huge, and we can actually talk about it because, I mean, from a New York, like Rocky Horror in New York at least, and we'll talk about it later, but yeah, no, there's a very, very big line to be drawn.
Right, that's kind of, that was a guess, but I thought it was an accurate guess. Anyway, so yeah, so this is an Alan Parker movie. It was actually inspired, I guess, producer or talent manager David De Silva saw production of A Chorus Line, and there was a reference to the New York City High School of Performing Arts, and he was inspired by that to create a story around students who go through.
And again, not trying to pull us out of order here, but I just think it's hysterical since because of this movie, they greenlit doing the film version of Chorus Line, which I also actually really enjoy, but which ended up being a flop. So, you know.
You know. I mean,
it all goes back and forth.
Funny how these things work. Anyway, so yeah. So De Silva talked to playwright Christopher Gore, and I guess Gore wrote a script, but then Alan Parker got involved, and I believe he rewrote the script, and I think he rewrote it to be a darker and more sort of dramatically hefty piece, you can tell there are, it feels like there are a couple of different sort of strains in this movie. One is that sort of musical, the impromptu musical sort of youth quake energy, and the other is sort of like this very heavy takes on people's lives as they, young people's lives as they try to sort of, you know, grow up in a world where, as the drama teacher says, you're going to suffer.
Right.
And some of them suffer, they do. So that was that. And I guess a lot of the people who are in the movie, cast members, like I know Gene Anthony Ray and Irene Cara, had actually gone through the School of Performing Arts, so there you go.
And if we just want to talk about really quick, music and art, which is how it was known in New York. It was the high school music and music and art and performing arts. It was just known as music and art. It was essentially the fourth specialized high school in New York. You know, New York public high schools, there was a specialized set.
Right.
Where you had to take an exam or an audition to get in.
Mm.
Music and art obviously being the fourth. The other three are Brooklyn Tech, Bronx Science, and Stuyvesant, for which there's one test and you get into which one based on how you do. Music and art later did merge with LaGuardia High School.
Huh.
So now it's the LaGuardia High School of Music and Art and Performing Arts, I believe.
Cool. That I did not know.
Weirdly, it didn't merge until 84. So right before the show started. And not long after the movie, they were just like, fuck it. We're out.
Now, if I recall correctly, they didn't actually film at that on location, no, right?
Because they wanted to, and the school administrators basically saw the script and were like, no. this shit is just way too, it's full of curses, and there's, drug use and sex.
Right.
And the people doing the movie got really pissed. And there was apparently a big shouting match. And so they found an abandoned school building and painfully recreated, down to the worn, dented look of what music and art looked like. So that is literally what music and art looked like. It's just not being filmed there.
Cool. Yeah. No. I figured as much. It looked like high schools that I've been to on the eastern, on the east coast. Yeah. So yeah, that was quite something. Anyway, fame. I don't know. I I feel kind of done talking about some background stuff, frankly.
Right. We can loop back to some of it later. Yeah. Because there is some other interesting shit there, but whatever. Mm-hmm. Plot-wise, I mean, it really is just like, what, this is, like, essentially you watch a group of kids who audition and go through their entire high school career?
Yeah. Yeah, it's very deliberately broken down to four sections. Auditions, yeah. Freshman, sophomore, or junior, senior. I can't remember how American high schools do it, but that's...
No, it's five sections because they five add auditions. Sections.
That's right, auditions.
Really, that works as like kind of a prequel, right? Like, it's not given its own section name. Everything else is like freshman year.
Mm-hmm. It actually says auditions at some point. So they so it's actually titled the auditions. Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, no, it goes through, you know, all 4 years and kind of all four seasons. They did like film it over the course of 11 months that they could get all four seasons in to visually kind of strike the difference.
Yep.
But again, because of the size of the cast and the amount of ground they're trying to cover, like 4 years of people's lives. Plot-wise, the past, here's some characters. Like, yes, every character has some sense of arc. But compared to, like, scripts these days, like, they are barely there.
Yeah, I think, when I was watching it, I think there was a point. And I think the point was when Bruno's dad shows up and starts playing Fame.
Yeah.
Which apparently all the people who danced were dancing to Donna Summer's Hot Stuff.
Right. Because they hadn't finished the song.
They hadn't finished the song, which is weirdly like that scene in Desperately Seeking Susan. When they're not dancing.
Or the end of...
Or the end of Buckaroo Banzai.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Is there a conspiracy? I'm going to say yes.
Yeah, musicians are slow. Anyway.
Yeah, that's right. But anyway, yeah. When they're all running out to the street and dancing and annoying people because they're kids, Bruno's dad shouts something along the lines of like, "My son's performing at Madison Square Garden." I don't remember the exact line, but I was like, "Oh, is this going to be like a? Are they picking up a particular storyline that they're going to stick to?" And as the movie went on, I'm like, oh, they're not. And then another character was like, oh, that one, like the character Lisa, the bad dancer. You know, you think she's going to commit suicide. She doesn't. She's like, I'll get into like acting or whatever. I'll show them. And then she disappears from the film. She might as well
have because in the original script, she did commit suicide.
Oh,
okay, and then the studio was like, "That's too fucking dark."
Gotcha.
And so they kind of retagged the scene.
Uh huh.
But they didn't have anything else for her because, as far as she was, they were concerned when they were writing the script, like she was dead.
Well, you see her at the end singing the Body Electric song. I hope
they would have done that even if she had committed suicide.
Me too.
Because it's kind of that Buckaroo Banzai thing again, right? Like, it's just...
Yes. Exactly. They all come everyone, together.
Even if they did.
Exactly. We're showing you, like, this transcendent plane in which the dead and the living can join together in song.
Also known as Graduation.
I loved their... During the graduation sequence, there were several students at the camera seemed to not zoom in on, but certainly... place, and I'm like, those students have not been in any other part of this film at all. Why are we looking at these people?
Well, I mean, some of them I noticed, like, you'd seen, like, in the auditions, and I think it was more of one of these, like, remember these kids? Yeah, I guess, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure one of the singers was the girl who was doing the Towering Inferno audition for the beginning.
Her a couple times throughout the movie.
You do, but there's another guy who... And I noticed this because he kind of looks like Seth Rogen, like a young Seth Rogen. And I was like, oh, that guy looks like Seth Rogen. And I would have like noticed him before. And then later on, I'm like, hey, there's that Seth Rogen guy again. Like, I guess he was there all along.
Yeah. the real and Seth guess, Rogen lookalike was the friends we made along the way.
Exactly. And I guess Leroy somehow is graduating. Although, did he learn to read? Fuck if I know. But he's still there. I mean, whatever. I'm assuming he managed to pass and had a... Like, it feels like there's all kinds of different movies going on in Fame. And Parker is just like, you don't need to see how all these movies end up. You kind of know them. And they're moving on to different things. This is a movie that runs on vibes. And
I mean, and let's be honest here. If Altman had done it, we would be praising it for that.
Oh, exactly. I know.
And I don't think it's not worthy of praise. I'm just saying, like, this is the sort of thing that you and me both kind of fall for. So, hey.
Oh, I know. It's true. I do think, yeah, you know, the Altman comparison occurred to me, in several ways. And I actually think the scene where with Coco being humiliated and having to like take off her top, that felt like a very Altman-esque scene, because Robert Altman liked to film women being sort of violated and crying, weirdly enough. But a lot of people seem to like doing that in the 70s and 80s. But that was the weirdest thing, because after that scene, I think that's the last Coco scene until the graduation number. And I'm like, yeah. what a grim way to like.
Well, I mean,
leave off.
If you notice, I don't know if the original intent was a whole lot cheerier. I certainly know that Parker darkened the hell out of it, because the entire movie, as much as it's called Fame, is about essentially failure.
Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, the last real scene we see with Ralph. It's, you know, him and Doris break up, and he is having the worst night that he's had, and he's, like, you know, taking drugs and being a failure.
Yeah.
Like, everyone's story just kind of ends up terribly.
It kind of does. But the weird thing is that because of the way it's all sort of, because of that final number and the fact that they're all still there and they're all still singing and dancing, you get the sense that these failures are just a step along the way for their whole lives.
Right.
Like, you know that all of them, even if, like, what they're doing, if they've crashed and burned or they're experiencing sadness, humiliation, defeat, you know that it's that more is to come. And maybe they'll continue to fail, or maybe they'll just, you know, maybe Bruno and Coco will, you know, start that band together, for example. Sure, hope they do. I think those two crazy kids can make it work. Personally, I'm with Bruno's dad.
But no, it is a movie about failure. I mean, which is a weird choice.
Well, there's that one character that you see only a couple times, Michael.
Right,
Michael. Who early on is sort of this. He's positioned to be like a great big Hollywood actor. And then the next time you see him, he's waiting tables and sort of saying, well, yeah, I had some meetings. I had a good time. I was on a soap opera. And then he's like, hey, can I take your order? The fried clams are good. It's like, ooh, yeah. That was, it's like, yeah, all these people are probably primed to fail. I think Doris probably gets, I don't know. I think she gets one of the better storylines, or some one of the more sort of joyous storylines, despite the breakup.
Sure. I just think it's there is a kind of brutal honesty in the film, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's also very, very 80s in that sense.
Oh yeah.
You know, like Saturday Night Fever, it's there's kind of that tinge of the 70s. You know, like, life sucks and we just kind of got to get through it.
Yep. Yeah.
Sort of married with what was about to come with the 80s. It's an interesting moment in time.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, the sort of the weird sort of optimism of a lot of 80s stuff is that hasn't happened yet. Like, a lot of them shooting around New York City. I mean,
yeah,
that was not New York at its best. I kind of expected the Warriors to jump out and start. They like, come out and play. at any moment. I mean, and to have sort of Leroy sort of going off, sitting amongst wreckage and carefully, you know, trying to read out or sound out like a Maytag ad, while three other guys, you know, pass a bottle around like a burning trash can. It's right. Like, Jesus, this is grim. This is some grim stuff, Alan.
Yeah. And it's just like, you know, again, background wise, like you can see where it came from, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was one of these I want to write about, like, the hell I went through.
Yes.
And of course, it was originally titled Hot Lunch, which I still am amazed that anyone thought that was a good idea.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that they kind of...
Well, there is a reason that they changed it.
Yeah, because Hot Lunch apparently is a slang term.
Well, it was literally, there was a porn movie.
Yeah.
Called Hot Lunch, and they were just like, let's not... Just okay, never mind. But I love that the reason that there's that weird ass line that doesn't land with the, you know, all we're guaranteed is seven classes and a hot lunch.
Yes.
Was originally supposed to be like a title call out. And that just makes that line so much worse.
Oof. Oof. Apparently Parker went with Fame because he liked the Bowie song.
Yeah.
Which, sure. I would have called it the Cafeteria of Chaos. That's what I would have called the movie. And there would have been many more scenes of like the cafeteria sort of like bursting out into like songs spontaneously.
See, I would have called it High School Musical.
Yeah, that could have worked.
I'm just saying it wasn't taken then.
Oh, and the recent Disney movies could have been called Hot Lunch.
See?
The musical.
Yeah.
Yeah, that all makes sense.
But, yeah, I mean, like, there's not really, you know, it is. It just exists in a weird way. Do you want to talk about the music specifically for a minute? Because...
Yes.
I always think of this as a musical, and realistically...
Uh-huh.
Three songs? Four songs?
Yeah, that's the weird thing about it as well. That's in my brain always thinks of this movie as a musical, and it isn't, but it still is. And I think part of it is, of course, you've got, I think, the cafeteria scene where they sort of break out into song,
right?
Spontaneously. Just, I mean, as silly as parts of, like, aspects of that scene can be, it's pretty amazing, like just the way that was filmed and edited.
Oh yeah,
and that was like, just there's some excellent things about it. And there's a guy in a pink top hat, you know, he just shows up, and maybe the Seth Rogen looking guy was there too. I didn't see him, but who knows? And of course, you have, you know, people dancing spontaneously in the street. I think it's got like the spirit of a musical, and also. See, the individual scenes seem to be structured almost like musical numbers in a way. Like you've got
a little
these,
bit, yeah.
Like, thinking particularly like when Leroy sort of loses his temper in the teacher's class, and he like runs out swearing and screaming and then starts breaking glass.
In her library,
which doesn't get him expelled. Okay.
Not only doesn't get him expelled, but when you see her later asking about his book report, she's putting books back in the library and there's no glass anywhere.
Yes.
Like, they didn't even fix it.
I know. Well, that tracks with the high schools I went to.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, people ripped out the cubicles around the washroom stalls. Yeah, that's not going back. Anyway.
Right.
But yeah. So there's that. And also the thing is that the way... The transitions from one scene to the next, especially when they're within the school, are always done with audio cues, often musical audio cues from a different room that sort of bridge it into a different scene. But it's almost done like on the beat of the action.
Uh-huh.
And it, I mean, one, the effect is to make it seem like you're moving seamlessly from like number to number. to scenes that aren't numbers but are scenes, but also makes the entire school feel like this organism, this sort of large living thing. And that, I think, is probably, I think this movie for me, one of the main pleasures is about that editing, because it's fucking brilliant. It's just amazing.
Yeah, structurally, like, this thing is a weird beast, right?
It is. Yes, it is. It's not interested in what a lot of standard movies are interested in. It's got
right, and you still get like through lines that you can see and you pick up constantly, like what's her name? Doris and Montgomery's constant trying to, like, you know, be actors. And, like, we're going to go out and I'll pretend to be blind and we'll panhandle, and, you know, all this. And so it's this thing of, like, you cut to them and you're like, what shenanigans are they getting up to now?
I know, I love that. Yes.
That's, you know, you cut to, like, Bruno, and it's, what shenanigans? And it's just, you know, they each have their little silos that they're in.
At some point, I in my notes, every time there was a Doris and Montgomery scene, I'm like, where's Bruno? Is he listening? And is he going to be a huge asshole about it? And then it was like, yes, and yes. And of
course, Ralph.
Ralph, not Bruno.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, Bruno, man, that guy, screw that guy. Fuck you, Bruno.
And that's the other thing. It's like, the movie very clearly sets up Bruno and, I mean, even the poster sets up Bruno and Coco to be the main characters.
Exactly. And then they're kind of not. They're just kind of.
They really aren't.
It's like, if I can picture them being the main characters of a different movie, just not this one. This one, they've got other things to do. We've got the weird sort of love triangle, like sublimated love triangle with
with
Montgomery, Doris, and Ralph.
Yep.
Ralph. Boy, that was good. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Barry Miller was in Saturday Night Live. I think that's where I know him from. Or Saturday Night Fever, I mean.
Yes.
Was it live? Yeah.
Yeah, he was in Sunday Beaver.
Yeah, okay, that's what I thought. Because I saw his face, I'm like, uh-huh. But there is something else I want to talk about. Okay. I want to talk about the ages of the characters. And the audition scene. Because I was watching, like, the audition scene where you get Leroy dancing, essentially doing a striptease for the female teachers. And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, is he supposed to be 15 or 14? Or what the fuck is going on?
I mean, there is that. And the weird bit that sticks out, and because they cut Debbie Allen's character basically to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she was originally actually supposed to be a student.
Oh, okay.
Who was kind of helping out on auditions and was going to be Coco's rival.
Ah.
And once you and you know, obviously in the TV show, that's kind of where Debbie Allen lives, right?
Yes, yes.
But in this, because you don't get that, you think she's just a teacher and it's wildly inappropriate.
Ah, okay. This makes
it is less inappropriate than you might think. It's still wildly inappropriate, but
yeah, no,
it's at least like 0.5 further away than you might have worried.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing was it wasn't even that it was like inappropriate. It was in like this like different galaxy of inappropriateness. I'm like, this is just pure bizarre fantasy land. But I like it. But it's funny, you can tell. But I also really enjoy that scene because it's very clear that this multi-knifed, you know, guy who doesn't want any part of this, clearly this is his place. Oh. And you know,
also his girlfriend who is there to audition, like, just her rising anger at the entire scene is so
I know,
like, it's just one of those weird great dance numbers.
I know. Yeah,
just because of how bad she is.
Yes. And like at some point, one of the teachers, maybe it's Debbie Allen, and she's a disaster, and like that line, actually, it's totally superfluous. I mean, that's for the people who like have their eyes closed during the scene, because it's so clear that like, but the best part is when she begins to realize it, as you say, her rising anger,
yeah,
and just her like just disgust,
trying to like run in front of him.
Yeah.
And again, and the capper for me, like, that is actually one of my favorite bits, you know, in I mean, the audition, I do think that the audition section is possibly the strongest section of the film.
It definitely is. I mean, it is between sort of the editing back and forth, the character.
Yeah.
So good.
But I'd say that out of that audition scene, like, that dance scene is straight through to the capper is the strongest part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Just for that cap of her finding out that, like, she's out and he's in and he didn't even, like, mean to audition. And she's going on this rant, like, fuck this school, this whole place. And it's, you know, it's such obvious, like, shut up, I don't care, you care. But it's the student who gives her the paper who is 1,000% unfazed because this is not the first time she's seen it.
Yes. Yeah.
That brings home the, this is where we are now.
Oh.
You know, like, that kind of outburst, like, that's just Tuesday.
Yeah.
And it's just, it really sets the scene well. We mentioned Altman before, for mm-hmm. obvious reasons. This is very Altman-esque.
Yep.
And, I mean, you know, we will eventually, because I know we have another Alan Parker film, I believe, on the list. Oh, no, we don't have it on the list. We decided not to do Commitments because
right. We
would just go on about the Commitments endlessly. But, you know, Alan Parker directed the Commitments.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, doesn't do Altman often, right? That's not like it's a thing. But drawing a line between this and MASH, I think, is interesting.
Oh, do tell.
Well, both of them are kind of, again, that Altman, one of them is actually Altman, and the thing that made Altman, but the other is just Altman-esque sort of, here's a whole bunch of characters, you're going to follow them through kind of their random things, right? Here's all their throughput, here's all their through lines, rather. Here's, we're going to touch base, we're going to build stories with them. But there is not enough time in a single film to get deep with any of them.
Mm.
Not realistically, right? We can scratch the surface, we can kind of head fake toward deep, but it is a superficial version of deep at best. Agreed?
Yeah.
And both of them went on to become way more popular TV shows. And I think it's just both of the stories were very specifically kind of built, even as films, to be TV.
Huh.
You know, you look at MASH, you're just like, yeah, this format, this kind of constant, like, vignette of this war, this would easily go on for 2 or 3 years on a TV show without a problem. You know, you look at Fame, and you're like, yeah, this would work way better as a TV show, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and it worked eminently well as a TV show.
Right. And it's just interesting to me, because I feel like these days, if you tried to make this movie, no one on earth would let you make this movie as a film this way.
Probably not.
But they would let you go over to, like, you know, Apple TV and do it as an 8-part miniseries.
Yep.
Or a show. Like,
you couldn't make Fame today.
And again, it's just because, again, structurally, like, it is TV.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because TV used to be looked down on, I think that they didn't even consider it.
Yeah, and I think
until it was already famous.
And I think that's one of the funny things about watching this, about watching the movie with the TV show in the back of my head. There are all kinds of storylines that I thought were going on in the movie, but I realized this is the show, like, it's the television show that I'm sort of thinking about all these sort of stories that are allowed to breathe and continue.
Yeah. Yeah, I have not watched the TV show since I was a kid and I watched it.
Yeah. One things I do remember about the show was that the music is also very terrible, by and large.
Yeah, I also just remember that, like, it somehow went on for 6 years, and that feels like it's at least 2 to 3 years too long.
Well, considering that, you know, it's the story takes place over 4 years, yes, that is too, that is a few years too long.
No, season one is just auditions. Okay, that actually would have been amazing, and I would watch an entire season of just the auditions.
It would be very funny to watch 20 episodes of people running around with instruments and stuff. Oh my god. I would love that. Yeah, no, I really want to watch that now. not that, but I really want to watch the show again. Just to see if it's as fun as I remember.
No, I get that. Like, there is part of me that kind of wants to watch Fame again. I don't have time, and I'm watching other stuff, and so I'm just like happily letting it burn out of my system. Because again, it's not good.
No,
it's fine.
No, it's fine.
But it was mid '80s, like early drama. And yeah. We remember these. Like, they were overwritten. They were overacted. They still felt like they had to wrap up every episode somehow.
Yeah. It's it was a TV writing of its time.
Yeah, I mean, there were standouts of that time, but I don't think Fame was really one of them.
Nah.
People in the listeners, you'd be like, the fuck? How dare you?
It also reminds me of The Paper Chase, which came out around the same time.
Yeah.
As a movie, and then was spun off into a television series, which I also enjoyed a lot when I was a kid for some reason. I don't know why a soap opera type show about a bunch of lawyers, you know, law students really kind of got me, but it did.
Yeah, I can see it. But looping back to, you know, Fame.
Oh, yes.
Because Fame. That's where we are.
Frame.
Frame.
I'm gonna hang a picture. It's gonna go on the wall. Frame.
Frame. Yeah. Jesus. You just completely derailed everything. So I did find it interesting. You mentioned Rocky Horror earlier.
Yes.
And of course, I say famously, you know, I say this, but like famously, they were looking for a scene for Doris to have her kind of like aha acting moment.
Right.
And Alan Parker ended up going to Rocky Horror in New York, witnessing this, and deciding that that was it.
Yeah.
And so you have to, like, yes, Rocky Horror, like the midnight show in Rocky Horror, it started in New York. It was a big thing. He got, you know, a lot of the actual people there were in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that is when, I'm pretty sure if I remember this right, that is when it went national.
Uh-huh.
The whole, like, doing Rocky Horror Nights, you know, like, every week at, like, you know, the midnight showing, and we're going to play along and all this. I'm pretty sure, like, this movie was a large cause of it.
Yep. That's like I said earlier, I don't know if we were recording at that point. I saw that, I'm like, I bet this is what pushed this over the edge.
Yeah, no, that I was just waiting until we, you know, had talked about other stuff to loop back.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I really do like the Rocky Horror bit. It was, again, interesting for me because at the time I hadn't seen Rocky Horror, right? Like, I was a kid. I'd seen the TV show some, and I was like, oh, there's a movie? Okay, I'll watch that. Mm-hmm. And then, like, this Rocky Horror scene comes out, and it treats it like everyone knows the movie, because everyone who was an adult kind of did. But I'm just completely confused watching this as a kid.
Yes. I never saw it as a kid. I don't think I saw Rocky Horror Picture Show. I knew of it, but I don't think I saw it until maybe 1990 or something.
Right, like, well, no, me either. What I'm saying is, because I saw Fame then.
Right.
And, you know, also, you gotta remember, like, 1980, like, home video wasn't as big a deal. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you could go see Rocky Horror and just rent it.
Yep.
You know, you watch this, and you're like, what the fuck is that thing? And then you just kind of forget it, because you're not old enough to go to the midnight showings.
No.
And personally, I do feel that going to the midnight showings is the worst way to see Rocky Horror for the first time in existence.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun, at least once. Like, it was never my thing. God knows. Of course I went at least once, because everyone goes at least once.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to know the show first, at least in passing.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to follow. Like, the first time I saw it, I think I was at a showing with, like, it was packed full of people who had all the props. They knew all the lines, everything. And it was just... It was fun, but it was also like, I have no fucking idea what is going on in this film. because people are just screaming asshole
right
regularly. I'm like, okay, well, I'll see it again sometime. I actually rented it.
It's like I saw it, you know, the same way, of course, once, you know, but yeah, I was lucky enough to actually just rent it at some point and just watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, that is some Fame. Do we have anything more to say about Fame? I'll tell you something that boggles my mind about Fame.
Please.
Is that Jerry Hamblin was nominated for Best Film Editing for Fame and did not win, which to me is kind of a...
That is a little weird. What did win? Do you know?
I do not know.
I'd be curious.
Let me find out. Academy Awards, 1980. Winners and nominees.
Well, while you do that, I haven't gone to high school in, you know, like late 80s, like 89 is when I started high school in New York, and I didn't go to music and art. But it is interesting to me because, like, that was, because again, I grew up there. It was really fun to just see the New York I remember from when I was a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when I got to high school, like, yeah, the high school buildings were still kind of run down like that. Like, it just, there was a weight of reality to it that I appreciate even now. That I don't know if it doesn't work if you didn't grow up with it because you're just like, oh, maybe they're faking it. No, that was just, you know, what New York looked like then.
Fair enough. Oh, okay. You know who won for best editing?
Yeah.
Looks like it's Tess Schumacher for Raging Bull.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's fair.
Yeah. So, yep, that's a stiff competition. Michael Gore won original score for okay. Fame. So,
yeah, and the song won.
Yes, and the song won as well.
But yeah, I mean, Fame was a huge hit, and of course, everyone tried to copy it, and everyone failed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the reason they failed is actually that specific thing that Parker, I know, got pissed about the TV show, which every copy of Fame, every time they redo it or, you know, because there is that remake, you know, or do the TV show, whatever, it's nowhere near as dark.
Mm.
You know, everyone's like, every movie that's kind of like, oh, see, look, it's like Fame, like the Coors Light movie, which I do enjoy. Is nowhere near as dark.
Yeah, I think that's really what sets it apart. I think from all these other films, I agree.
And it's kind of interesting, like I said, like when you're watching, you're just like, wow, this is kind of fucking grim, but uh-huh. It is also memorable. And just looking at Parker's stuff, like why we both love The Commitments versus That Thing You Do, right? Is The Commitments is kind of fucking grim in a weird way.
It is. Yeah, that's Parker's sort of thing. I mean, this is the guy who made Midnight Express.
Right. Not to reduce him to these two movies.
Right. Angel Heart, which was also very grim.
Yep.
Does not hold up quite as well in some ways.
I'm sure.
But still creepy, but yes, kind of questionable in other ways. At any rate, yeah. And it's when you say... Being grim, and I mentioned Coco's scene, you're kind of like, you're watching her sort of like go to this apartment. She knows something's wrong. Like she's hoping that everything is okay, but she has this notion that maybe this guy is not on the up and up. And then, you know, when he says, you know, can you take your top off? And then says, you know what? I thought you were a professional. And I'm like, okay, here's where she gets up and just runs out. She doesn't.
Can we just talk about the fact that this movie does this thing specifically so often where this movie is very, very tense in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
We're just like, you know, like the, oh, I'm going to walk onto the train. Like, you know, oh, this is where she, you know, this is, she's going to get up, right? This is where Ralph's like little sister, like doesn't like, you know, get attacked by a junkie.
Right.
But it's the build up to those scenes, every single one.
Yep.
Is incredibly tense.
Mm-hmm.
And it leaves you where, like, because you're just watching a series of vignettes at a certain level, right?
Yeah.
It is just this constant tenseness.
Mm-hmm.
And it, I mean, it makes the thing compelling.
Yes.
But it's interesting just because it's not something that you think about being this really, like, almost tense thriller.
Yeah.
But it, in an individual, like, overall, the movie is in no way structured like that.
No, but it's clearly
in the individual moments, it is 1,000% structured like that.
Jesus, yeah, you're right. Yeah, it seems to be where Alan Parker lives, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and he doesn't do it with everything he does, but, like, when he does, he knows how to build it. And again, it's also the editing, it's, you know, it's the camera work, it's everything. Just leads you down this road of something bad is about to happen, something bad is about to happen, and you know what it is, and you're trying to, you know, hoping that the characters are going to, like, get out of it, and sometimes they do. Mm-hmm. And that is the thing I really appreciate, is sometimes they do, sometimes mm-hmm. they don't.
Right.
You don't know. It's not one of those things of, oh, it's always bad, or it's always safe. It changes every time.
Yeah,
and it just makes you feel uneasy and unsafe watching the film.
Mm-hmm. And because
it got to the point... Sorry, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, just because all the characters are young, like they're always sort of taking, like, risky decisions. Like, I literally thought that something really bad was going to come out of the Rocky Horror Picture Show screening thing.
Right.
I thought, shit, Doris is, like, she's relaxed, she's having a good time, she's getting high with Ralph. I'm like, something really bad is going to happen.
That's what I'm saying. There's a scene, like, not long after some other really tense scene, it might have been the train sequence, where we see Doris and her mother just walking along a train platform.
Oh, yes.
And they're arguing about Doris changing her name.
Yep.
And you start off with this kind of completely darkened, like, tunnel of a thing, and then mm-hmm. some footsteps, and there's Doris and her mother. I'm like, is one of them getting knifed? Like, it was just...
Yeah.
Because at that point, like, the movie plays New York as a dangerous place, but also just plays everyone's life as on the edge. And that's very purposeful thematically, right? Like, they've put mm-hmm. their lives on the edge chasing fame. Sure.
Yes.
But the masterful way it works, without announcing itself, and to a degree that you don't always notice when you're watching, mm-hmm. you just feel it. And I think that is a lot of the staying power of the film.
I completely agree. Although, I will tell you, and I even took a note about it, the most dangerous thing that any of the characters do is Doris and Ralph kissing the subway windows.
Hey, you grew up in New York, you've licked the subway pole, okay? You've done it. You have. I'm sorry.
I just
was
watching that.
It's why, in case
that.
Of, like, zombie plague, like, New York would be fine. Like, that's... Yeah.
No, I get it. I get it. No, I was watching that, I'm like, wow, that's probably... I just thought... You couldn't put that in a film today. But that, actually, you probably wouldn't put in a film today, because people would be like, I can't believe they kissed the subway glass. Ah, it's so gross. I was like, oh, that's cute. I'm like, also, ooh, I would not want to kiss that glass myself, but okay.
So, actually, I want to loop back to something that you started to touch on, and then we moved on from it. We moved into a different way than I thought we would, and then we just kind of dropped it.
Part of the course.
We were talking about age for a minute.
Oh, yes.
And I just wanted to kind of go back to that for a second, because what I thought you were going for, and you weren't, was just the, you know, obviously we used to cast people who are much older than their actual age for younger roles.
Yeah.
But I submit that this worked for a very good reason.
Do tell.
When you are in high school, like, when you were in high school, right? Did you not feel like, well, I'm already an adult, like, I'm grown up? Like, when you grew up watching stuff with people in high school shows, and they all looked like they were, you know, obviously in their 20s, mm-hmm. it felt right to you, right? Like, that kind of felt like how you viewed your friends.
Yes, because we all thought we were much older than we were.
Right.
And that's exactly how it works, and that's why it works so well in Fame.
Right. And I wonder if, because, I mean, obviously as we get older, we realize that, like, people who are, like, you know, I don't know, 17 look what we think of as 12. And it's just, it's a trick of age. It's a trick of the eye. But I do wonder if some of this push towards, oh, like, you know, the Stranger Things kids are all the right age and blah, 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 is actually losing them audience in the kids because it's piercing that bubble?
Maybe.
It's something I don't think I've ever seen talked about, and I might actually want to sit down and write about it and get yelled at by the internet for being wrong.
Oh, yeah, no, please do. I would like to see that. Oh, no, I think
but you see what I'm saying, right? Like, it does hit us that way, right? That's not just, again, like a trick of the eye on my end. That really is how that works.
Yes. No, that's exactly it. Because we're looking at these people. I mean, Alan made a really, really good point about the structure of this movie and the thing about age ties into it, is that the movie is sort of designed to be immersive, and the camera is often kind of positioned not like you're like watching like some observer, but like you're right there. You're right in the hallway or on the stairwell. Like you're kind of watching it, and you are one of those students in so many cases. And which kind of ties into the whole Rocky Horror Picture thing, where you're watching, but you're also kind of participating. Like the lines between people and performers kind of get blurred. So essentially you're watching this, and there's this process of sort of identification that's going on. And mm-hmm. I think seeing people who are clearly not teenagers and not aging either, because they're already sure. adults, works perfectly.
Well, like I'll say, like, if you go back and notice, because I noticed this at one point and went back a little bit for that mm-hmm. exact thing, right? Like, you can see the camera is again, like, it's immersive, like fucking watching The Shield. Like, it's done as a documentary.
Yes.
Except, if you notice, like, you'll get camera angles that are, like, right up against, like, you know, basically, like, you're in a crowd with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
All the teachers are always shot with more distance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're
you're like always immersive with the students and distant from any adult.
Yep. That's exactly it's right.
Such weird, careful work. And again, I think this is, and it's interesting to me that, again, like, just think about Fame and think about all the people I've heard talk about it in over the course of our lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it is famous enough that it comes up. I don't think I've ever heard anyone actually sit there and be like, well, you know, like Fame, because it's popular, because the music is great, or the this. And it's like, no, it's great, and it's memorable, and it's powerful, because it is unsettling, and it drags you in way too close, and then makes you nervous for 2 hours. While it is telling you that it is about this other thing.
Right.
And you remember the telling you part more than you remember the details of that thing. Yeah.
But at the end, you know, it's all just part of growing up. And then you get together with your pals and you graduate and you sing the Body Electric. And there you go.
That song is so terrible.
It's a very terrible song. There's no doubt.
It's a very terrible song that is essentially saying, like, it doesn't matter what we do. We're all fucking dead anyway. Like, I look forward to when I die. Like, if you look at the lyrics to that song.
Right. I mean, it's pulled straight from Whitman, from Song of Myself.
Sure, but like, I toast my own reunion when I become one with the sun.
With the sun, that's right. Yeah, it sounds
I'll
like...
look back on Venus, I'll look back on Mars, I'll burn with the fire of Tell Me in Stars. It's like, yeah, this is not... Yeah.
It's like Logan, it's like, there are these, the Alan Parker is actually making Logan's Run.
I submit that what they should have done for their end song, I don't remember. I think it was out by then. But for their end graduation song, they should have sung "My Shit's Fucked Up." That's my pitch. The entire class, dance number and all.
Yep. My shit's fucked up. I would love it. I would. I believe that was in the remake. So there you go.
Oh, God. I kind of vaguely want to watch the remake someday.
Yeah, Debbie Allen was in the remake.
Of course she was.
She played the princess.
I like Debbie Allen, but, like, Debbie Allen is just so much, oh, there's something Fame-related? Shit, I gotta get in that.
Right.
I appreciate it, you know? I get it.
Yeah.
But also, I'm gonna laugh at it a bit.
Just a little bit.
Anyway, I think we are coming to a close on Fame here.
I think we have exhausted Fame. I did my frame song.
You did
joke.
The frame joke, which I deeply appreciate you doing. Next week, we are going to take not a break from the podcast, but a break from movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like we have done once before, I believe.
Once before.
Did we?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah, the episode we lost. So hopefully we won't lose this episode.
291 will be the lost episode. I don't even remember what we talked about. Whether
that was a League of Their Own.
Oh, right. A man.
Which has still not been renewed. And fuck everything.
That's a real shame.
But this time, next week, we will be talking about the first season as a whole, I like to think, of Poker Face.
Poker Face! Yes. That will be...
And we will make a deal right now to not invoke Lady Gaga.
Okay. Okay, I can do it.
I'm sure you will break this deal.
Yeah, that's going to be tough, but I will give it. I'll do my best.
But yeah, we're gonna take a little break and from the movie stuff and talk about Poker Face next week. So all 10 episodes are out. There will be a second season. You can go watch it.
Can we rank the episodes? I like a good ranking of episodes.
We can rank the episodes.
Cool.
I mean, I bet we agree, but I don't know.
Probably we mostly agree. I think actually we might end up with a few at the bottom, but we're kind of being shuffled around. That's my guess, but we'll see.
Yeah, that feels right. But yeah, we'll do that, and I don't know, play some music?
Yeah, let's play music.
Woo, music.
Fame!